Conversations with Other Writers, with your host, award-winning travel writer and novelist, C.M. Mayo.
Michael K. Schisler is professor of humanities at the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico City, where he teaches courses dedicated to Latin American art and literature, pre-Columbian Mexico, and colonial Mexico. He earned his PhD in Hispanic languages and literatures from the University of California, Los Angeles, where he specialized in the literature and arts of colonial Latin America, particularly New Spain. He's the author of many articles devoted to the interpretation of Latin American literature and culture, as well as several books, including the biography of Guadalupe Amor, La Undécima Musa, published in Mexico in 1995, and the biography of one of Mexico's best-known journalists and writers, Elena Poniatowska, An Intimate Portrait, published by University of Arizona Press. In 2007, the University of Texas Press published his edition of Alma Reed's long-lost autobiography entitled Peregrina, Love and Death in Mexico. In 2011, with his co-editor Amparo Gomez Texicuapan, Schisler published Tuyo Hasta Que Me Muera, Epistolario de Alma Reed y Felipe Carrillo Puerto, a collection of letters, love letters, between Alma Reed and Felipe Carrillo Puerto, who was the socialist governor of the state of Yucatan. Our conversation took place in March of 2012. So I'm in the Fondo de Cultura bookstore called the Rosario Castellanos in Colonia Condesa, and this is like the most cool, biggest, beautifulest, most happening bookstore in Mexico City. It's noisy because there's music, there's not too many people, it's early in the morning, but they're shoving books, so you're going to have some ambiance there with the thumping of the books. And I'm here with Michael K. Schisler.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm really excited. I have so many questions for him because he has so many books. But I think of all his many books, the ones that we can probably fit into our conversation today are the two that have to do with Alma Reed and Pita Amor.
Oh, okay.
And maybe we should start with Pita Amor because I understand that that's why you came to Mexico.
Well, to a certain extent, I came to Mexico with a group of graduate students from UCLA in 1992 and met a wonderful man who's no longer with us named Ángel de la Cruz, who used to dance at the Cabaret Leda, where Pita Amor and María Félix and Dolores del Río would mix with Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera and Lumpen of the Low Life, etc. And he really interested me in the life and the work of this extraordinary woman, who, by the way, turned out to be Elena Poniatowska's aunt. So it's a very interesting family to that in that degree. And I came to Mexico City and I found her. And she was living at a kind of ramshackle hotel called the Hotel General Prim in the Colonia Juárez. And I remember that I entered the lobby and asked about her and got a kind of strange response from the woman at the reception desk, but she pointed to an orange telephone and said, "Well, you can call her if you want." And I did, and her booming voice came across on the other line, and "¿Qué quieres?" And, you know, "What do you want?" But since I could speak Spanish fairly well, she thought that was interesting, but she was really excited because I had read her work and I didn't just know of her persona. So she asked me to meet that very evening.
The persona, I have to tell you, when I started, I've been here over 25 years, But when I started writing poetry and translating Mexican poets in the early 1990s, I started to hear about her. I never met her, but she sounded scary.
Well, she was kind of scary, especially in her old age. She died in 2000, and I met her, as I said, in 1990, actually, not 1992. I met her before that. And she was the youngest daughter of a rather large Porfirian family, that is, a family that had lost a lot of its wealth due to the Mexican Revolution. She was a young girl who always got her sister's hand-me-downs and was always trying to, well, attract attention to herself. And that was something that never ended, you know, this cultivation of her persona. But she didn't have much of a formal education. Her beautiful home, which is now a store that sells auto parts on Abraham Gonzalez Street in the Colonia Juarez, had a library, and she started reading poetry of the Spanish Golden Age, and with her father, she would recite poetry with her sisters and her brother at the dining room table, and I think that's how she got her start, and that's why her poetry has always retained that classical structure. The rhythm and the rhyme of these Spanish modes that aren't necessarily as well known in English, although some of them are, like the sonnet, the décima, the lira, etc., the kind of poetry that was written by Santa Teresa de Ávila or by San Juan de la Cruz or by Lope de Vega and all of those great poets of Spain's golden age.
This really, I think, is a great achievement of your biography of Pita Amor, who actually, if you're going to Google that book, you'd look up Guadalupe Amor, La Undécima Musa, the 11th Muse, Salvador Novo called her. But she really, when I first started to hear about her in the 90s, was really a figure, a ridiculous figure. She was someone that people gossiped, oh, can you believe she did this? Can you believe she said that? Can you believe she wore that? She wasn't someone taken seriously. And what you've done with this biography is looked at her entire life and her entire work and given it a context and shown the seriousness of what she and the accomplishment of what she really did as an artist.
I tried to unearth the Guadalupe Amor of the past, the woman whose work was published by Spain's foremost publishing house, Aguilar, in the 1950s, the poet who was compared to the great authors of Spain's golden age. And I looked carefully into her writing and also into her persona. But Pita cultivated that image of decadence and perhaps craziness to such an extent that I think that it took over her own being. And when I met her, she would almost refuse to speak in anything but verse. She would not talk about the past. She would not allow herself to be touched. She had terrible reactions towards Mexico's middle and lower class citizens. She would say,
to put it mildly,
she would, you know, mango-nosed and all these horrible things she would call people. But I think I saw through that because, unlike many Mexicans who had seen her on television, since she had, you know, these programs in the 1950s where she would recite Spanish mystical verse wearing a very deeply cut dress, let's say, and one time one of her breasts fell out on television, and that was a terrible scandal, and the League of Women, you know, called Mexico City's television stations to complain. But anyway, I didn't get all of that. I didn't have that imagery. But I did when I met her, and I saw this woman wearing this bejeweled gown stumped over with four rings literally on every finger and with a cane, who came over and looked at me and announced her presence and then turned around and sat at a different table, that's when my understanding of the other Pita would begin. And I followed her to the table and I sat down and I asked if I could tape her, and she allowed me to do so. So I treasure that recording from way back when. And she began to spin together so many different poems by many different authors, including herself, of course, and really not talk that much about the day-to-day Pita, just kind of become engrossed in her literature. But I acquired all of her books, and I studied them, and I had been fortunate enough to do my PhD at UCLA in Latin American literature, so I kind of had some perspective. Oh, there goes a
book. That was a book.
That was Kita, I'm sure. Hay fantasmas.
Sí, dijo. You have a little interview, a Q&A with her at the back, the last interview, and it's just an extraordinary thing to read where I'm not going to read it since it's in Spanish, and I think most of our listeners here are hearing in English, but she said things like, I'm divine, but I don't believe in God. I'm a friend of the devil.
That's right. No, she lived by her contradictions, you know, and she was never really easy to pigeonhole that way. And I'd asked her what she'd think about Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, Mexico's premier woman poet of the Baroque period, and she'd say, she's dead and I'm alive, therefore I'm victorious, you know, and that sort of thing. So really, you know, it was difficult that her personality didn't eclipse, let's say, her own writing. And her writing didn't evolve. It didn't take part in the different modes of contemporary or modern poetry as others might have, but it retained that very classical format, which to many people is unagreeable or disagreeable.
Let me read a short poem that she wrote to you.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is a little bit that will be in Spanish. Mike. To Mike. Al titán de los volcanes, de las veladas secretas, de las misteriosas grietas. Al titán de los afanes, titán de los huracanes, titán de mares convulsivos y de nocturnos impulsos, capitán de capitanes. So even if you don't understand Spanish, you can hear the music in that poetry.
Absolutely, and the vigor, because she was very emphatic about everything that she said, and she had a very particular way of saying poetry. She didn't like to declaim, or let's say to declare poetry, or recite, as you would say in English, only to say poetry, but boy, she would say it in a very interesting manner. But at times, because I did know her for 10 years, and we did kind of hang out, you know, she would like to drink very typical Mexican concoction, which is eggnog with a bit of liquor in it.
Rompope.
And after drinking some rompope, she would talk about her past and about her relationship with Frida Kahlo and with Diego Rivera and her often very negative opinions about, you know, their personas, not always, you know, and other writers of the time and such. So I felt that I was very fortunate because I got just the tale of a group of very extraordinary individuals that worked and created in Mexico's post-revolutionary culture, and she kind of extended a bridge in that sense because she outlived many of them, if not all of them, and she opened herself to me and she allowed me to accompany her. You know, she accused me of stealing one of her medallions at one point, and then later I came back and she was screaming out the balcony that she found it hidden against her left breast, you know, and she gave me these drawings as kind of like a consolation prize. So, I mean, I did have to suffer certain, you know, embarrassments, let's say.
You must have been an angel of patience.
I did have to be very patient, and, you know, when she would look in her little boxes, she had about 47 of them on her coffee table, and open and close the lids up to 87 times for each one before we were able to leave, and then ask me to lock the door, and if I said I thought it was locked, she would make us go all the way up the stairs again to make sure that it was locked. So you had to learn her tics and her ways of being. But again, that's what would outshine her literary creation. But I think that if at one point maybe we could translate some of her early poetry, her book of short stories, her autobiographical novel, which is fascinating because she divides her life by the spaces that occupied that home where she grew up. So she'd talk about things related to the hall and related to the dining room, and that way kind of, you know, weave together her own story.
None of these have been translated.
Nothing, to my knowledge, by Pita Amor has ever been translated.
And wait, wow. We're in March 2012. That is an amazing statement. One of the most important poets of the 20th century in Mexico.
I think that it's also
to a certain extent understandable, because she really viciously defended her independence, and she would have no problems attacking the major players in Mexico's cultural and political regime. And therefore, she was isolated by many of them. She used to call Octavio Paz and literally scream her poetry into his ears, and he, I guess, would pass the phone on to his wife, and his wife would, bravo, Pita, I'd like it very much. And then on television shows being asked about him, say, Octavio Paz, he rings a bell. You know, she would just refuse to play that game, and I think that's a very admirable thing, because so many Mexican women creators have either been lost in a male shadow until they're rediscovered. Think about Frida Kahlo, and she only had one or two exhibits in her whole lifetime. Or Tina Movolti, who died in a taxi cab, utterly forgotten.
Well, Frida Kahlo now is just so ubiquitous, but when I came here in the mid-80s, she was not the figure she is. I mean, now you go anywhere and everywhere, there's Frida keychains, Frida this, Frida that. I live in Coyoacan, there's a trolley that goes down the main street. It's the Frida and Diego trolley. I mean, it's just become such a, she's, I mean, nobody would question now that Frida Kahlo is a major Mexican artist, but that was not always the case. And for those who are not that, who are listening, who are not that familiar with the Mexican literary scene, I think it would be impossible to overstate the power Octavio Paz had in his lifetime. And so for someone to attack him and expect to be published was just unthinkable.
Yes, and then she'd really go out on a limb by stating on the television that she couldn't stand Carlos Monsiváis, a very famous Mexican writer and chronicler, and that her family still had the lances that they used to murder his horrid race. You know, that would really get her in terrible trouble. Because she was such a racist and such a classist, and that I hold against her.
Well, she liked to push everybody's buttons.
She did. She did. And she didn't leave anybody out. She would make fun of her niece, Elena Poniatowska, who's such a wonderful, valuable woman here in Mexico today. But she was clear in her convictions, and her life was poetry, and she wasn't going to let go of that. But she wasn't going to be brought down by these powers, you know, these powers that be. You know, she'd have interesting conversations with the president of Mexico when he stood before her nude portrait and said, you know, that's a painting of my soul. And he replied, well, you have a nice little pink soul now, don't you?
Which president was this?
This was Avila Camacho.
Avila Camacho. Yeah. Oh, my God, that was back in the 50s.
That was back in the 50s. That was a Diego Rivera portrait.
Well, now, moving on to, I would like to talk about Pita Amor for like 10 hours, actually. but moving on to Elena Poniatowska, her niece. Elena Poniatowska, for those not familiar with the Mexican literary scene, I think it would be fair to compare her to Margaret Atwood.
Yes.
With whom
Susan Sontag.
She's a major, major figure. But not only is she a major literary figure in Mexico, but she's a person who, she has a very unusual personality. We were recently at a press conference together, you and I and Elena and some others, to promote the San Miguel Writers Conference, which took place in February. I was just amazed to see how Elena is so sencilla, very unpretentious. And she literally, over the period when she was speaking, you could just feel the energy in the room. All these sort of journalists just kind of on their conveyor belt, I guess, doing what they had to do, covering another press conference. And I could see how she just conquered them. She just conquered them with her sencillez, but also she has this heart, this enormous heart. It's really just energetically extraordinary to see.
Well, Elena is also a story of contradictions, because she is really a princess, and her mother as well, but she's turned against that ever since she came to Mexico.
Literally, she's a descendant of the King of Poland.
That's right, Poniatowski, and was born in Paris, France, and never knew that her mother was actually Mexican until she was informed that they would be heading with her sister, fleeing World War II, back to Mexico, where her grandmother lived, and her grandmother had this huge dog sanctuary in the Zona Rosa area, where she had over 60 dogs and a very interesting character herself. But Elena immediately became interested in her roots, and she learned Spanish from her nanny, Magdalena, and that's why she speaks, you know, like an everyday Mexican would speak Spanish. It's not a hoity-toity kind of accent that she has, and she's always been out, you know, to protect the underdogs, and lately has been interested or very much involved in Andrés López Obrador, Manuel López Obrador's campaign. And for that, she receives horrible phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning because her name's in the phone book. You know, she's very sincere, like you say, but she's an icon in Mexico. And she's the woman who wrote the book about the massacre of students in 1968 in Tlatelolco.
La Noche de Tlatelolco, which is...
Massacre in Mexico.
Massacre in Mexico.
And she wrote, let's say, the book about the Mexico City earthquake of 1995, Nothing, Nobody, Voices of Mexico City's Earthquake. She wrote this incredible historical novel about Tina Modotti, who came to Mexico with Edward Weston. So she's been fundamental in exploring and recreating the lives of these extraordinary individuals, and also of being on the beat as a reporter. You know, that she is first and foremost, she considers herself a journalist and interviews hundreds and hundreds of people to put together a book of many voices, like the two that I just mentioned, for example. You know, she wrote a book, a wonderful little book about Angelina Beloff, who was Diego Rivera's first wife and the mother of his child who died of meningitis when he was less than a year old, if I'm not mistaken, and brought her to the fore, even when Diego Rivera walked right by her in Mexico City, didn't even recognize her, you know. So she's been a voice of the underdogs, and one who would tell you that Mexican women, especially the creative types, have either lost their minds, like Pita Amor, or have died, you know, in very strange circumstances, like Rosario Castellanos.
Rosario Castellanos was the ambassador to Israel, and she died in a household accident.
Yeah.
And kind of a digression. What was that?
Well, I've been told that she had arrived from a trip and gone into her house. She did not have her shoes on, and that there had been a bit of a flood in the house, and she stepped in a pool of water and turned on a lamp and was electrocuted to death. But you don't
get one
story. And she lived a very unpleasant life with her husband, and she was always made de menos, you know, to feel less. And a very unhappy woman who wrote incredibly lucid and brilliant examples of what she lived and what many people in Mexico lived. So Elena has been very important in that way of rescuing these figures and bringing them out in recreated form, let's say, in the form of a historical novel or an epistolary novel, like is the case of Angelina Beloff. And unlike her Aunt Pita, many of her works are available in English.
Well, now you also know a lot about Mexican women writers, going all the way back to Sor Juana, speaking of writers who had an unpleasant end.
Bueno, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz was a child prodigy, and she grew up near the volcanoes of Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl in what is now the state of Mexico in Nepantla. And because of this extraordinary intelligence that she had, she finally convinced her mother. You see that she was born out of wedlock and her father disappeared. He was supposedly from Guipúzcoa, a part of northern Spain, and she was allowed to go live in the home of her wealthy aunt and uncle in Mexico City, the De Mata family. And from there, she became a lady-in-waiting in the court of the viceroy in Mexico, and there became very close to one of the vicereins who was there at the time and who became her mecenas and her sponsor when she decided that her only option as an illegitimate daughter of the Mexican, let's say, middle class was to become a nun. And she had her dowry, and she entered a convent that was rather strict and rigorous, which she couldn't stand. She hadn't had the best of health since she was a child. And she ended up in the Jerónimas convent here in Mexico City, and that's where she lived and died and wrote all of her work. I mean, from charming plays to incredibly profound poetic works like The Dream, for example, her sonnets, her metaphysical, her love poetry,
It's just she's extremely multifaceted and a fascinating woman to investigate from all of those myriad angles.
And then the church said you can't write anymore.
That's right. That's being reconsidered now by certain scholars who say that because there was no mention of a plot against her, that there was a plot against her. So others would say that there is no evidence, so we can't show this. However, I always just bring up her reply to Sor Filotea de la Cruz, who was actually a man who was a monk and a bishop, and he would write to these different nuns, and I think that he got some sort of a, let's say, erotic arousal out of these exchanges with the nuns. And she replied to him in what is really an autobiographical format about how, you know, God had made her this way, and she had been punished for being such every step of the way, and didn't feel that this was correct. But her books were taken away from her. She did sign a vow in blood, with her own blood, that she would dedicate herself, you know, to religious thoughts towards the end of her life. And she did die a tragic death, a victim of the plague, one type or another, we're not sure which, in 1695.
She had a library that was famous.
She did. She had a very famous library and a collection of, let's say, pseudoscientific instruments, and I think a certain quantity of pre-Hispanic objects that she had probably acquired from her friend, Carlos de Sigüenza y Góngora, who was a former Jesuit and a true intellectual in Mexico, and someone who questioned Father Kino's statement that the different comets that passed by were actually God's anger and wrath in the form of divine flatulence, and really looked into the fact that the Chinese had documented these comets and that they were, let's say, some sort of a scientific phenomenon. So her own library, yes, was considered the largest in the New World at the time, and it contained many different volumes of religious treatises, of philosophical treatises, and perhaps even some dangerous books, you know, like Athanasius Kircher, for example, who was a Jesuit universalist, a fascinating character, who tried to relate everything in the known world into one sort of an axis. And, for example, he would be the one that, with Carlos de Sigüenza y Góngora, would say that, Atl is water in the Mexican native language, and that's just like Atlantis, and therefore this must be the lost Atlantis, for example. And that's just one of many. Uh-huh. So she was involved in all of that. Well, we would consider it now to be like pseudoscientific research and thought. She's still geocentrical in her science, let's say. It was against the modes of the Catholic Church to be able, you know, to go beyond what Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas had determined. But she would do it to a certain extent. In her poem, The Dream, she would say that she was almost separated from her bodily chain because she knew that your chain had to be there until you were dead, and if it wasn't, it was heresy. So she was very aware of that, and she talks about not wanting ruido con la Inquisición, noise with the Inquisition, because she's towing a very fine line.
It was a scary time in Mexico. I mean,
and she had to confront a terrible misogynist archbishop whose name was Aguiar y Seijas, who thanked God that he was nearsighted so he didn't have to see the face of a woman, who threatened to tear up the flooring of his home if he had known that it was stepped upon by a woman. And he also
a troubled individual.
Very troubled. And he also wore a hair shirt, I think is what they're called, and he didn't bathe, and I guess that only his closest servants could stand being near him. And he was one that was fundamental in, you know, taking Sor Juana and putting her, let's say, in her place. That's Octavio Paz's interpretation. That is the general interpretation. There is a new school that is accused of wanting to, like, canonize Sor Juana and doesn't see that, you know, there was any sort of a plot against her by the what they would call the princes of the Catholic Church in Mexico. I don't subscribe to that interpretation.
Well, Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz, we could talk about her for about 5 hours, too. She's an amazing figure, and you have so many books. And the one I really want to talk to you about, and here we are, we're about probably close to halfway through the interview. the one I most want to talk to you about is actually the book by Alma Reed that you discovered and you edited and introduced. It's called Peregrina, Love and Death in Mexico. And the other book that just came out, when did it come out?
Just about 3 months ago.
This was the collection of letters mm-hmm. between Alma and her fiancé, Felipe Carrillo Puerto, who was the Red governor of Yucatan, who was executed by firing squad.
That's right, that's right. I feel very fortunate because now that I think about it, a lot of my quote-unquote discoveries have been the result of friendships. And it's because of a friendship that I established with an older woman of Polish descent, curiously enough, Lisette Parodi, that I learned of a man named Richard Posner, who at that time lived in Brooklyn, who turned out to have been the best friend of Alma Reed's. And when I met him, I was interested in another Mexican writer, Salvador Novo, with whom he had worked because they were both interested in English language theater. But he would mention Alma Reed and say, there's a story there, and kind of, you know, not understand my lack of interest until I went to Yucatan and I met a woman who was doing research on popular music, and she was very interested in a song called Peregrina, Pilgrim, because it was created for and dedicated to Alma Reed, who is known in Mexico as La Peregrina.
And we have the opening lines of it in the book.
That's right.
I won't read the whole thing, and I don't even know the tune. Peregrina de ojos claros y divinos y mejillas encendidas de arrebol. Peregrina de los labios purpurinos y radiante cabellera como el sol.
That's right, and we can take advantage of this technology, and I can send you a little music file so you can hear Peregrina de ojos claros y divinos. And it's sung today by so many trios here in Mexico City. If you go to the San Angel Inn, for example, they'd be happy to sing it to you. And I'm going to Mérida tomorrow, and let me tell you, they all know the song in Mérida, Yucatan. But to make a very complicated story short, he told me that after her death, he had gone to her apartment because he was officially her literary heir. And I guess what he did was take all the papers that were on her desk and files, and he put them into this very appropriate henequen bag that Alma had, I'm sure, bought in the Yucatan. And he had left it in his apartment since 1966, which was a year before I was born.
That was the year she died.
She died November 20th, 1966, the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, which is very emblematic for reasons that, of course, you could find out about in the book. So that's where, after several tries, I found it in the year 2001. And it was
in the closet.
In the closet of this apartment, which had been uninhabited since 1984. And it was full of grime and mildew, but he still paid the telephone bill. And my mother said it was like a time warp because he had all his clothes, and they were like from the disco period, you know, in his bedroom. And there was canned food in the refrigerator. And we went twice and looked in file cabinets and looked in bookshelves and everywhere you would consider that this probably could be located. And I finally called him, and he was pretty old and not senile, but a little bit unpredictable. And he said, I'm seeing a green bag. And I said, a green bag? But what do you mean? And he said, look for a green bag. Well, we went back. That time we had the key to the bedroom, which is the only space that we could not investigate, and we couldn't find anything. And at the very end, I said, you know, I'm going to look one more time in that bedroom. And I reached up behind these horrible towels and sheets and that had been there for 20 years or I don't know.
Oh, they must have smelled.
They were terrible. And something kind of prickled me. And I pulled it, and it fell down on the floor, and it was that bag, and it was full of all of these file folders, and each one of them was a chapter of the story, and then one of them said, Letters and Maya Poem. And that was just a few of the last letters sent by Carrillo Puerto to Alma Reed that she had been using, I believe, to finish the last chapters of her book, because it wasn't until I would meet another individual who had the entire final version, for some reason I don't understand, that I could complete this edition and, you know, write my introductory study. And it was a wonderful adventure meeting people who knew her and going to the Yucatan and finding her tomb and realizing what a fascinating figure that she was, because after her experience in the Yucatan and the tragedy that she lived, I mean, they told her about his death by giving her a telegram when she was rehearsing for her wedding in the lobby of the Fairmont
Hotel. It was a week before the wedding.
It was a week before the wedding that she found out about all of this. And even so, put her life back together, headed to the Middle East, worked in archaeology, met a childhood friend named Eva Sekilianos, came back to the United States, to New York City, and founded the Delphic Society. And in that context, and thanks to Anita Brenner, she met Jose Clemente Orozco, for whom she would become mecenas and bootlegger and godmother, I think is how she defined herself.
She was a very, you know, it's similar to what you've done for Pita Amor in showing us that this is actually a major figure on many levels. And yet, Alma Reed, towards the end of her life, was not known. And I just want to indulge me to let me read the first half of the opening paragraph from the foreword by Elena Poniatowska.
Of course.
I remember Alma Reed well. During the 1950s and 1960s, we would often share the elevator going up to the editorial offices of The News, a U.S. daily associated with the Mexico City newspaper Novedades. She used to sing to herself during the ride up from the first to the third floor, keeping her eyes closed and only opening them when it was time for both of us to get off the elevator. She wore old-fashioned dresses, always covered with lace and frills. And when she wore black, she looked quite lovely, because her face was quite pale, and the dark apparel made her seem still more distinguished. Some mornings, I would happen to ride up, standing in between Alma and Yucatecan poet Rosario Sansores. They seemed to be engaged in a duel of hats, and theirs were always covered with veils, flowers of all sorts, and even stuffed birds. But Elena goes on in this beautiful, beautiful foreword that she wrote to explain that she had no idea who Alma Reed was. She had absolutely no idea, and yet here was this major figure who not only had this tremendous love affair with probably one of the most charismatic figures in Mexican politics of the 20th century. She was within a week of becoming the first lady of the Yucatan, which would have, I think, probably changed things in many ways. And she also was someone who wrote important books about Mexican art. She received the Águila Azteca, which is the Aztec Eagle, Mexico's highest award to a foreigner. She was an important journalist in her own right. I mean, her life has many chapters where she's influenced policy. I mean, she's just had so many achievements on so many levels.
That's right. I mean, she had really been forgotten and was working in the 1960s for that English language daily that was mentioned by Elena Poniatowska. And some people would accuse her of trying to spin and to live by her legend. But as Richard Posner would tell me, well, that's all that she really had, because she'd lived a freelance and rather precarious existence before Mexico City and, of all places, Mobile, Alabama, where she had a radio program and created a group that was called the Friends of Mexico, for example. But indeed, she had this relationship that went beyond, let's say, the romantic, even though some of the letters are quite cursi, as you might say in Spanish, you know, in this collection. A lot of them have to do with a vision for the future of the people of Yucatan and the way in which they were to enrich the lives of those people who had been so oppressed by the hacendados, the divine caste people of the Yucatan Peninsula, and by the Catholic Church, which of course embraced it and supported it. So they were real trailblazers of that time, and it was a terrible thing that the De La Huertista rebellion caught up with Felipe Carrillo Puerto, and that he was killed along with four of his brothers and his assistant.
It was a massacre.
A massacre in January of 1924. So on the one hand, we have a document, which is her autobiography, which is, let's say, the official version of her life.
Hang on. I think we've got some kind of a blender going on there. A smoothie action. Okay, so.
So, yes, in the victim of the De La Huertista rebellion, which just, you know, put her life on hold for a while, but she regrouped and she got to New York and she started that, the Delphic Society, and then she opened a Delphic Studios gallery, which was essentially dedicated to Jose Clemente Orozco. She was the person who got him his commissions for all of his U.S. murals.
Well, he was a major Mexican painter, one of the most important muralists, and her help at a crucial point in his career was fundamental.
I believe so. You know, they talk about the big three Mexican muralists of the 20th century, Diego Rivera, Jose Clemente Orozco, and David Alfaro Siqueiros. Some people would just say Orozco, Orozco, and Orozco because he is considered the greatest of the three, a neo-expressionist painter who did murals, who also, of course, did work oil on canvas and drawings and prints. But yes, he was a depressive personality. He was in one of his melancholic modes, let's say, when Alma tracked him down on Riverside Drive at a rather decrepit studio that he rented. And she was the one that got together the works for his first exhibition in New York City. Of course, you know, Orozco's wife, Margarita, wasn't very happy with all of this, as you could imagine, down in Mexico City, and accused Alma of, amongst many things, I suppose, of just wanting to market like the Mexican curio aspect of Orozco and just wanted to show paintings of the Mexican Revolution. But, you know, the history doesn't bear that out, because if you look at his work at Dartmouth College, Prometheus Bound, if you look at his work at Pomona College or at the New School in New York City, you'll see that he was influenced by many things, but one of the important factors were the ideas that were brought by Alma Reed and Eva Sakelianos from Greece, where they had started these Delphic festivals with Angelos Sakelianos, who's considered a very important modern Greek poet, who of course is long deceased, and brought that to New York City and attracted a very interesting group of people, amongst them Khalil Gibran, who drew her portrait.
Yeah, that's in your book, or rather the book you introduced.
That's right,
by
the
Alma
edition.
Reed.
Sure.
Yeah, Peregrina.
That's right, and you know, after the New York, she went to California with him and then came back, and then finally in the mid-50s...
With Orozco,
yes, for the Pomona Commission. And there they met Ansel Adams, and they brought Ansel Adams, and his first exhibit ever was at that gallery on 57th Street in New York City. And she also, I'm going out of order, but was one of the first people that would write positively about the Mexican government under Obregón, and she would publish dozens of editorials in different newspapers around the United States. And curiously enough, after a year of that publication, the U.S. finally did recognize Mexico's new government. And on her, not let's say application, but on a text that was put together by her supporters, that's one of the things that's mentioned as to why she should receive Mexico's Aztec Eagle Award. And before that, let me just say that the reason that she became known in Mexico in the first place is that she saved a boy from hanging.
Right, Samuel Ruiz in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, Samuel Ruiz, who was underage, who was involved in what was an attack on his employer.
But he didn't speak English.
He did not speak English. They would not assign him a translator or an attorney that spoke English. He was just told what he was to do. He admitted his guilt, even though it turned out that he wasn't guilty. And he was on death row, and that's where Alma would find him, because she worked at the newspaper, The Call, in a very curious position as Mrs. Goodfellow. And she'd write columns about the needy and the disadvantaged people in San Francisco. And I've always thought that that might be how she came into contact with Mexico and the Mexicans. And she would say her father, because of his businesses, did too and knew a bit of Spanish, etc. But that's why Obregón invited her down.
Yeah, it was a VIP trip. President received her. And, you know, just to put some context here, because of that journalism, of that activism, they actually changed the law in the United States so that minors could not be executed.
That is correct. It's called the Sailor Bill or the Boy Hanging Bill, and it's on the books up until today. And that's because of the crusade that Alma organized in San Francisco under her pseudonym, let's say, of Mrs. Goodfellow. And then later it did...
Then she came back a second time to Mexico in 1921, right? Because she was hired by the New York Times to cover the archaeological digs in Yucatan. And Edward Thompson was excavating the cenote at Chichen Itza.
That is correct. I think the date was rather 1922 or even 1923. I have to check my sources. But basically it's true. She was assigned by Adolf Ox, who was the director of the New York Times in that period, to accompany a group of archaeologists from the Carnegie Foundation, or the Institute, rather, to the Yucatan Peninsula, and in particular to document their excavations at the Maya classic site of Chichen Itza. Now, unbelievably, at that time, it was owned by this man. He was an amateur archaeologist named Edward Thompson, not Eric Thompson, who is a very important professional archaeologist of the Maya of more or less the same period. And he had been dredging that holy well, that sacred cenote at Chichen Itza for years, since the late 1800s, when he arrived with his wife and his family, and had been sending the objects through diplomatic pouch, of course illegally, to the Peabody Museum in Massachusetts at Harvard University. And Alma, I don't know, because of her charm or because he felt certain confidence with her, would be the first person that he told this to, and Alma would break the news and create, of course, an international scandal where Mexico required either the return of those objects or $1 million. So, and that suit went on for quite a few years.
And I think eventually the Peabody won the suit in the U.S. courts and gave back some of it. I'm sure there's a whole book right there.
Yeah, there is a whole book right there. Some of those things were returned. Alma, you know, never let go and tried to get that done, let's say, in a just manner. But in a certain extent, it wasn't until the 1970s, and it was with a trade that they would return some gold pieces for some jade pieces that were given by the Mexican government, which doesn't seem very fair to me, but at least Alma exposed the situation.
And that is when she met Governor Felipe Carrillo Puerto.
That is right. He was the socialist governor of Yucatan.
A very close ally of Obregón.
He had fought with Zapata and the Mexican Revolution in the state of Morelos. So he had a lot of knowledge about what this revolution was all about, and he was one of the people that implemented its ideals in a most thorough fashion in all of Mexico. And this was way out in Yucatan, where you could only get there basically by taking a boat from Veracruz.
This very isolated place, and it's hard to imagine what it really was like at that time. The economic organization was basically slavery.
That's right. It was indentured slavery on the Sisal or the Henequen haciendas. And that's the reality that Alma encountered when she went, and I think was just so enamored of this, well, Greek god, as she called him.
She called him a Greek god. Now, when I look at his picture, you can see the charisma. It's
absolutely
an extraordinary charisma. And I think also, not only was he, you know, a revolutionary hero, the first democratically elected governor, way ahead of his time and place in many regards. He was a feminist.
That's right. His sister Elvia set up, you know, leagues of women in the Yucatan. They were the first to vote in Mexico's history. I mean, they had rights regarding birth control and things that were unheard of in the rest of the country.
Yeah, and this was a place where traditionally it had been ruled by La Casta Divina, the descendants of the conquistadors from Spain, very conservative, very Catholic. But another thing about him is that in pretty much any state in Mexico, the governor is a kind of god. I mean, they are very, very, very powerful people. Kind of the state is a kingdom in a way. And he was considered or said to be the direct descendant of Nachicocom, the last cacique of the Mayapan Federation. So he was considered by the local people a kind of prince.
That's right. He was considered, let's say, as a continuation of resistance, because it took quite a while for the Spaniards to overtake, to conquer the Mayas of the Yucatan Peninsula, and Nachicocom was one of those revolutionary leaders that tried to get away from Spanish domination centuries back, let's say, he was also almost 6 feet tall, or maybe even a little bit more.
Where people tend to be very short.
But, you know, he did speak Yucatec Maya ever since he was a child. He translated the Mexican Constitution into Yucatec Maya so it could be understood.
Which was not what La Casta Divina would have wanted.
No, no, not at all, as a matter of fact, because they did hold those poor Maya Indians in a type of slavery. What do they call that?
Debt slavery, indentured servitude. Right, where you can only buy your food and supplies from the company store.
You can't buy them elsewhere,
and the prices are such that you're just in debt forever.
That's exactly right. So he was up against all of that, which was certainly a terrible reactionary state of things, affairs in the Yucatan. And, well, that to a certain extent explains his tragic demise, because he represented a very scary change, an unacceptable political, economical change for the powers that be, or that were at least, in that state. So, Alma, it's terrible the way that, you know, by little drips and drabs, she starts realizing in these letters, you can see it, that things are not going well. And at the very end, he says, please send me your next correspondence in code. There are bombs exploding outside, you know, my office. So those were the last words of Felipe Carrillo Puerto.
The letters you have in the new collection, the title is Tuyo hasta que me muera, I'm yours until I die.
That was what he wrote in his last letter to her.
The collection of letters between Alma Reed, Pixan Halal, which is Alma Reed in Mayan, and Felipe Carrillo Puerto, Hipil Zutul Che, from March to December 1923, at which point they ended. But not only do we have the transcriptions and an introduction to these letters, but we see reproductions of some of them. Like, I'm looking at one right now from Alma that's written on the stationery of the Waldorf Astoria, Dragonito Encantadoro.
You can also
enchanting
see
little dragon.
Spanish, yes.
Enchanting little dragon. And then his are typed in red ink.
On the
stationery of the, it says, Correspondencia Particular del Presidente del Partido Socialista, the personal correspondence of the president of the Socialist Party of the Yucatan. Inolvidable Alma, unforgettable Alma, he says.
That's right. Well, she'd received those letters at the reception desk of the Waldorf Astoria, and the person in charge would kind of give her a fishy eye when he handed over these letters and envelopes that had red ink all over them, which, of course, at that time was a clear sign of communism, you know, and something that just couldn't be.
Very scary. Well, it was a sudden thing. He was actually married to someone else. And in your collection here, you show the documents that he had, in fact, gotten divorced.
That's right, in part because I would like to set the record straight, because you'd be surprised and shocked as to the negative attitude that still is held against Alma Reed in the Yucatan Peninsula.
Well, I can imagine. He was married with children.
His divorce was in process. He had developed laws that were very liberal in the sense that either one of a couple could decide to ask for divorce and wouldn't have to have the permission of the other. People would say that he set that up just to be able to divorce his wife and to marry Alma, but it happened, it was in process before he met Alma Reed, so that's
not true,
yes.
Okay.
And that's to a certain extent, and, you know, people will say that he never divorced his wife. This is just not true, and that's why I included two different copies of the divorce decree, but I do recognize that he was able to do that without his wife's permission. But was it a real love? Because in Yucatan, they'll say that she was just an easy gringa who was out for an adventure that was kind of like one who wanted to go up, you know, certain political levels.
He'd had an affair with Catherine Ann Porter, the writer.
Yes, that's interesting. Yeah, that was before Alma Reed in Mexico City. He would take her to dance at different places around Mexico City. And Alma and Catherine never were friends, and I kind of see it as that, you know, Alma was the one who took the prize, even though that prize was so tragically destroyed when he was murdered.
It seems to me, though, from reading Alma's autobiography and the letters, that he really did very much intend to make her a first lady, and that their attraction was something genuine, but it was also, it had a dimension of the political to it. And I think that that makes these two works especially important in understanding the history of the Yucatan in the first part of the 20th century.
I think that's true. Because of his tragic demise, there wasn't time for a whole ideological construct to be developed. But Alma, because she demands, she sometimes begs for more information, has documented a lot of it that I think that otherwise would have been lost. And he criticizes her and says, "Oh, Mrs. Manager, Mrs. Journalist, I'm just going to call you in that way from now on, because all you can think about are those newspapers of yours, you know." And he wants more romance, he wants more lovey-dovey, but she wants pictures of the excavations around the Yucatan Peninsula, and she wants to know about his house for the children that's inspired by Plato's Republic. And she sees, I think, a soulmate in Felipe Carrillo Puerto. But she's very clear, and she wants that divorce. She wants to be able to marry him legally, and she can only do it with that document. He has a home that he's purchased for them to live in. It's a very incredible mansion. It's not what you would think for a socialist couple, but there you have it. The Villa Aurora that still stands in Mérida today. Lots of contradictions, but really these incredible intentions to raise the Maya race from generations of ignorance and repression and recreate the society in which they live.
It would have been a very interesting history had he lived and had she become First Lady of the Yucatan.
That's right. She was actually planning to write a book called Details of the Life of a Socialist Leader. And, of course, because of his tragic death, that could never happen. And she says very moving things towards the end of her own introduction. And maybe as kind of a way to end ourselves, I could read that to you.
That would be wonderful.
She says, "Throughout all the years that have passed since that fateful dawn of January 3rd, 1924, Felipe Carrillo has retained, for me and for all who truly knew him, his creative force in the living present. I find no yesterdays at journey's end, for the images that have vanished from physical sight still dominate the inner prospect and are more intelligible for heart and mind than the concrete realities of the passing hour. That which was can never cease having been." These words of the 16th century Spanish philosopher Saavedra de Fajardo are now recalled with fresh poignancy in the ceaseless quality of everything that relates to Felipe Carrillo. But will his spiritual presence and influence function in continuum for the Maya race, the Mexican people, and for tomorrow's world? The date at which it all began for me is clearly noted between the purple leather covers of my 1923 diary. As I read its pages, memory reconstructs this beginning and all the unutterable magic and pain that followed as distinctly as though I were viewing the sequence on a television screen. And so my story begins.
Tell me about these books. The one that I'm looking at right now, I have it in my hand, The Peregrina, Love and Death in Mexico by Alma Reed, with your introduction and the foreword by Elena Poniatowska.
That's right.
That came out with University of Texas Press.
That's right.
It's an absolutely exquisite hardcover. Real collector's item.
I was very lucky to get a hardcover. In Spanish language, it's available in paperback. And I might add that it's an edition that has pictures in color, has a lot more illustrations. When I read that last segment, I mentioned, Alma mentions, the covers of this diary from 1923. And I want to just end by saying what a magical experience this has been, and that I was asked for a documentary program to recreate how it was that I found this document in that abandoned apartment, and I got permission to go again. And they told me, "Now, let's pretend that you're looking for the manuscript one more time, so why don't you go through the furniture and such." And the first drawer that I open, I see this purple-bound diary that says, "Diary, 1923, and it was the one that Alma Reed had used to recreate her own life story, and is now in my possession, and I'm beginning to transcribe it. It's very difficult to read in this 1920s handwriting, and perhaps publish an edition of her diary, which gives a very different perspective, a very intimate perspective on all that was going on in her life at that time.
That would be a wonderful thing to publish.
I think, what other person has this, I guess, good fortune, or maybe not, of having her official life story found and published, her personal correspondence found and having been published now, and now the most intimate part of all, which is her diary, which she mentions things that I still don't quite see how fit into the whole scheme of things, but I think it'll come out in the process.
It's a story that, once told, I think will be told and retold over literally centuries. And I think that it has a lot in common with the story of, say, Maximilian and Carlotta, very different figures, very different political persuasions, a different century. But, just this tremendous love in the early death of one of the partners and the political and historical importance of both of them. The visual drama, you can imagine the movie. She's wearing the huipil, there's Chichen Itza, there's the parrots and the flowers and this charismatic Greek god, Yucatecan prince. I think that it would make a marvelous movie.
Well, there is a movie, and curiously enough, Alma Reed is played by Sasha Montenegro.
Sasha Montenegro.
That's right, and it's called Peregrina, and it was done by Antonio Aguilar in the mid-1970s. Of course, it's only available in Spanish. And it's an interesting attempt, but there's so much more that could be done. And to be honest, there was a project to make a movie based upon her autobiography, but I think that it was shelved because of the economic collapse of the 2007-2008. But you never know, maybe I'll get a phone call or a fax one of these days and saying, the project's on,
I'm sure you will.
I think it's a great story, and what I was happy to do was to at least in part help set the record straight, and say that, no, she wasn't John Reed's sister. No, she wasn't a scheming gringa from California that had no political knowledge or ideology. She was a very complex human being. And if at the end of her life she really tried to get as much out of her relationship with Carrillo Puerto as she should, well, it's because Richard told me it's all she had left.
But I think, to give her more credit, I think that she probably was very aware of the historical importance of what she lived through with him and what he stood for. And she probably also realized if she didn't bring it forth, who else would?
That's true. And that was why it was sitting on her writing desk the day that she died, because that was what her plan was, to send the final manuscript off to Crown Publishers in New York, which did receive the manuscript a couple months later and denied publishing. They decided that it wasn't worth publishing. So
that reminds me of Giuseppe de Lampedusa's The Leopard.
There you go.
The publishers didn't know what they had.
No, they didn't. And I'm so glad that it was saved, because it's been a miraculous story. But to tell you the truth, the apartment was flooded.
I know. I was going to ask you about that.
Yes, it was flooded in a terrible rainstorm. And a lot of things were thrown out, especially those things that were in the closet, because that's where the water came through.
So you got it just in the nick of time.
I've always felt that Alma really wanted her story to be told, and I'm not that much of a mystical person, but sometimes I do think that she's there and she's kind of coaching me and she's making sure that these things happen.
I'm sure the world is much more complex than we can see or hear.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'll bet she was. I'll bet she was helping you.
She's here with us right now in her
big hat. I hope Peter Amor is not being too rude to her.
No. I think that they'll have to have mutual respect.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much,
now,
Catherine.
If people want to read more about your work and your books, they can go to your website, right?
Yes, it's www.michaelkschuessler.com.mx.
So Schuessler is spelled S-C-H-U-E-S-S-L-E-R, Michael K. Schuessler. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
From the bottom of my heart, I admire your work more than I can say. And I think anyone who wants to know more about Mexico, particularly 20th century Mexico, really needs to come and read your books about Pita Amor, Elena Poniatowska, Alma Reed. But also you have many other books which are also important. So please come visit his website and check it out. Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you. And all back to you. I say the same.
Visit again for more conversations with other writers, as well as other podcasts with your host, CM Mayo, at cmmayo.com/podcasts.
In 1911, Francisco I. Madero, leader of the Mexican Revolution and soon to be elected president of Mexico, published a secret book. Now, on its centennial, for the first time, it has been translated into English by C.M. Mayo as The Spiritist Manual. Find out more at cmmayo.com and dancingchiva.com.
Companion. The Los Angeles Times Book Review calls it a book to throw in a suitcase on the way to Mexico or just settling into a favorite patio chair. It will open your eyes and fill you with pleasure. Mexico Connect says, discovering it was like opening a door and walking into a brightly lit room filled with all kinds of literary treasures. Mexico, a traveler's literary companion, 24 Mexican writers on Mexico, selected by award-winning writer and translator C.M. Mayo, is available from Whereabouts Press. Look for it in bookstores and all major online booksellers. Hear a country speak. Find out more about Mexico, a traveler's literary companion, at cmmayo.com.